After they all screwed up, and today was John Russell's turn. Taking its chance to raise money by running drugs into Canada, the Warrior Society had made its mistake and allowed its plans to be overheard by a federal informant. They were in the ghostly remains of a farming town 6 miles from the Canadian border. The FBI hostage rescue team, as usual without any hostages to rescue, was acting its role as the Bureau's premier SWAT team. The 10 men deployed on the mission under squad supervisor Dennis Black were under the administrative control of the special agent in charge of the local field office. That was where the Bureau's customary professionalism had come to a screeching halt. The local SAC had set up an elaborate ambush plan that had started badly and nearly ended in disaster, with 3 agents already in hospitals from the auto wrecks and 2 more with serious gunshot wounds. In return, 1 subject was known dead and maybe another was wounded, but no one was sure at the moment. The rest, 3 or 4, they were not sure of that either, were holed up in what had once been a motel. What they knew for sure was that either the motel had a still-working phone, or, more likely, the subjects had a cellular brick and had called the media. What was happening now was of such magnificent confusion as to earn the admiration of Phineas T. Barnum. The local SAC was trying to salvage what remained of his professional reputation by using the media to his advantage. What he hadn't figured out yet was that handling network teams dispatched from as far away as Denver and Chicago wasn't quite the same thing as dealing with the local reporters fresh from journalism school. It was very hard to call the shots with the pros. "Bill Shaw is going to have this guy's balls for brunch tomorrow," Leary observed quietly. "That does us a whole lot of good," Paulson replied. A snort. "Besides, what balls?" "What you got?" Black asked over the secure radio circuit. "Movement, but no ID," Leary replied. "Bad light. These guys may be dumb, but they're not crazy." "The subjects have asked for a TV reporter to come in with a camera, and the SAC has agreed."
"Dennis, have you—"
Paulson nearly came off the scope at that.
"Yes, I have," Black replied. "He says he's in command."
The Bureau's negotiator, a psychiatrist with hard-won expertise in these affairs, was still 2 hours away, and the SAC wanted something for the evening news. Black wanted to throttle the man, but he couldn't, of course.
"Can't arrest the guy for incompetence," Leary said, his hand over the microphone. "Well, the only thing these bastards don't have is a hostage, so why not give him one? That'll give the negotiator something to do."
"Talk to me, Dennis," Paulson said next. "Rules of engagement are in force on my authority," Supervisory Special Agent Black said. "The reporter is a female, 28, blonde and blue, about 5'6". Cameraman is a black guy, dark complexion, 6'3". I told him where to walk. He's got brains and he's playing ball."
"Roger that, Dennis."
"How long you been on the gun, Paulson?"
Black asked next. The book said that a sniper could not stay fully alert on the gun for more than 30 minutes, at which point the observer and sniper exchanged positions. Dennis Black figured that someone had to play by the book.
"About 15 minutes, Dennis. I'm okay."
"Okay, I got the newsies."
They were very close, a mere 115 yards from the front door of the block building. The light was not good. The sun would set in another 90 minutes. It had been a blustery day. A hot southwesterly wind was ripping across the prairie. Dust stung the eyes. Worse, the wind was hitting over 40 knots and was directly across his line of sight. That sort of wind could screw up his aim by as much as 4 inches.
"Team is standing by," Black advised. "We just got compromise authority."
"Well, at least he isn't a total asshole," Leary replied over the radio.
He was too angry to care if the SAC heard that or not. More likely, the dumbass had just choked again. Both sniper and observer wore ghillie suits. It had taken them 2 hours to get into position, but they were effectively invisible, their shaggy camouflage blending them in with the scrubby trees and prairie grass here. Leary watched the newsies approach. The girl was pretty, he thought, though her hair and makeup had to be suffering from the dry, harsh wind.
The man on the camera looked like he could have played guard for the Vikings, maybe tough and fast enough to clear the way for that sensational new halfback Tony Wills. Leary shook it off.
The cameraman has a vest on. Girl doesn't.
You stupid bitch,
Leary thought.
I know Dennis told you what these bastards were all about.
Dennis said he was smart.
Paulson trained the rifle on the building.
Movement at the door.
Let's everyone try to be smart,
Leary murmured.
Subject one in sight, Paulson announced. Russell's coming out. Sniper one is on target.
Got him,
three voices replied at once. John Russell was an enormous man. 6'5", over 250 pounds of what had once been athletic, but was now a frame running to fat and dissolution. He wore jeans, but was bare-chested with a headband securing his long black hair in place. His chest bore tattoos, some professionally done, but more of the prison spit-and-pencil variety. He was the sort of man police preferred to meet with gun in hand. He moved with the lazy arrogance that announced his willingness to depart from the rules.
Subject one is carrying a large blue steel revolver, Leary told the rest of the team. Looks like an N-frame Smith.
Dennis, there's something odd about him.
What is it? Black asked immediately.
Mike's right,
Paulson said next, examining the face through his scope. There was a wildness to his eyes.
He's on something, Dennis. He's doped up. Call those newsies back!
But it was too late for that. Paulson kept the sight on Russell's head. Russell wasn't a person now. He was a subject, a target. The team was now acting under the compromise authority rule. At least the SAC had done that right. It meant that if something went badly wrong, the HRT was free to take whatever action its leader deemed appropriate. Further, Paulson's special sniper rules of engagement were explicit. If the subject appeared to threaten any agent or civilian with deadly force, then his right index finger would apply 4 pounds, 3 ounces of pressure to the precision set trigger of the rifle in his grasp.
Let's everybody be real cool, for Christ's sake, the sniper breathed.
His unertal telescopic sight had crosshairs and stadia marks. Automatically, Paulson reestimated the range, then settled down while his brain tried to keep track of the gusting wind. The sight reticle was locked on Russell's head, right on the ear, which made a fine point of aim.
It was horridly comical to watch. The reporter smiling, moving the microphone back and forth. The burly cameraman aiming his minicam with its powerful single light running off the battery pack around the black man's waist. Russell was speaking forcefully, but neither Leary nor Paulson could hear a word he was saying against the wind. The look on his face was angry from the beginning and did not improve. Soon his left hand balled into a fist and his fingers started flexing around the grips of the revolver in his right. The wind buffeted the silk blouse close around the reporter's braless chest. Leary remembered that Russell had a reputation as a sexual athlete, supposedly on the brutal side. But there was a strange vacancy to his face. His expressions went from emotionless to passionate in what had to be a chemically induced whipsaw state that only added to the stress of being trapped by FBI agents. He calmed suddenly, but it wasn't a normal calm.
That asshole SAC, Leary swore at himself. We ought to just back off and wait them out. The situation is stabilized. They're not going anywhere. We could negotiate by phone and just wait them out.
Trouble.
Russell's free hand grabbed the reporter's upper right arm. She tried to draw back, but possessed only a fraction of the strength required to do so. The cameraman moved. One hand came off the Sony. He was a big, strong man and might have pulled it off, but his move only provoked Russell. The subject's gun hand moved.
On target, on target, on target, Paulson said urgently.
Stop, you asshole. Stop now.
He couldn't let the gun come up very far. His brain was racing, evaluating the situation. A large frame Smith & Wesson, maybe a 44. It made big, bloody wounds. Maybe the subject was just punctuating his words, but Paulson didn't know or care what those words were. He was probably telling the black guy on the camera to stop. The gun seemed to be pointing more that way than at the girl, but the gun was still coming up, and...
The crack of the rifle stopped time like a photograph. Paulson's finger had moved, seemingly of its own accord, but training had simply taken over. The rifle surged back in recoil, and the sniper's hand was already moving to work the bolt and load another round. The wind had chosen a bad moment to gust, throwing Paulson's aim off ever so slightly to the right. Instead of drilling through the center of Russell's head, the bullet struck well forward of the ear. On hitting bone, it fragmented. The subject's face was ripped explosively from the skull. Nose, eyes, and forehead vanished into a wet, red mist. Only the mouth remained, and that was open and screaming as blood vented from Russell's head as though from a clogged showerhead. Dying, but not dead, Russell jerked one round off at the cameraman before falling forward against the reporter. Then the cameraman was down and the reporter was just standing there, not having had enough time even to be shocked by the blood and tissue on her clothing and face. Russell's hands clawed briefly at a face no longer there, then went still. Paulson's radio headset screamed, "Go, go, go!" But he scarcely took note of it. He drove the second round into the chamber and spotted a face in a window of the building. He recognized it from photographs. It was a subject, a bad guy. And there was a weapon there, looked like an old Winchester lever action. It started moving. Paulson's second shot was better than the first, straight into the forehead of subject two, someone named William Ames. Time started again. The HRT members raced in, dressed in their black Nomex coveralls and body armor. Two dragged the reporter away. Two more did the same with the cameraman, whose Sony was clasped securely to his chest. Another tossed an explosive flashbang grenade through the broken window, while Dennis Black and the remaining three team members dove through the open door. There were no other shots. 15 seconds later, the radio crackled again. "This is team leader. Building search complete. Two subjects down and dead. Subject two is William Ames. Subject three is Ernest Thorne. Looks like he's been dead for a while from two in the chest. Subject's weapons are neutralized. Site is secure. Repeat, site secure." Jesus. It was Leary's first shooting involvement after 10 years in the Bureau. Paulson got up to his knees after clearing his weapon, folded the rifle's bipod legs, then trotted toward the building. The local SAC beat him there, service automatic in hand, standing over the prone body of John Russell. It was just as well that the front of Russell's head was hidden. Every drop of blood he'd once had was now on the cracked cement sidewalk. "Nice job," the SAC told everyone. That was his last mistake in a day replete with them. "You ignorant, shit-faced asshole!" Paulson pushed him against the painted block walls. "These people are dead because of you!" Leary jumped between them, pushing Paulson away from the surprised senior agent.
Dennis Black appeared next, his face blank. "Clean up your mess," he said, leading his men away before something else happened. "How's that newsie?" The cameraman was lying on his back, the Sony at his eyes. The reporter was on her knees, vomiting. She had good cause. An agent had already wiped her face, but her expensive blouse was a red obscenity that would occupy her nightmares for weeks to come. "You okay?" Dennis asked. "Turn that goddamn thing off." He set the camera down, switching off the light. The cameraman shook his head and felt at a spot just below the ribs.
"Thanks for the advice, brother. Gotta send a letter to the people that make this vest. I really..."
And his voice stopped. Finally, the realization of what had happened took hold, and the shock started.
"Oh, God. Oh, sweet, merciful Jesus."
Paulson walked to the Chevy carryall and locked his rifle in the rigid gun case. Leary and one other agent stayed with him, telling him that he had done exactly the right thing. They'd do that until Paulson got over his stress period. It wasn't the sniper's first kill. But while they had all been different incidents, they were all the same, all things to be regretted. The aftermath to a real shooting does not include a commercial. The reporter suffered the normal post-traumatic hysteria. She ripped off her blood-soaked blouse, forgetting that there was nothing under it. An agent wrapped a blanket around her and helped to steady her down. More news crews were converging on the scene,
most heading toward the building. Dennis Black got his people together to clear their weapons and help with the two civilians. The reporter recovered in a few minutes. She asked if it had really been necessary, then learned that her cameraman had taken a shot that had been stopped by the second-chance vest the Bureau had recommended to both of them, but which she had rejected. She next entered the elation phase, just as happy as she could be that she could still breathe. Soon the shock would return, but she was a bright journalist despite her youth and inexperience, and had already learned something important. Next time, she'd listen when someone gave her good advice. The nightmares would merely punctuate the importance of the lesson. Within 30 minutes, she was standing up without assistance, wearing her backup outfit, giving a level, if brittle, account of what had happened. But it was the tape footage that would impress the people at BlackRock, headquarters of CBS. The cameraman would get a personal letter from the head of the news division. The footage had everything. Drama, death, a courageous and attractive reporter, and would run as the lead piece for the evening news broadcast for this otherwise slow news day, to be repeated by all the network morning shows the next day. In each case, the anchor would solemnly warn people that what they were about to see might disturb the sensitive, just to make sure that everyone understood that something especially juicy was about to screen. Since everyone had more than one chance to view the event, quite a few had their tape machines turning the second time around. One of them was the head of the Warrior Society. His name was Marvin Russell. It had started innocently enough. His stomach was unsettled when he awoke. The morning jobs became a little more tiresome. He didn't feel quite himself. "You're over 30," he told himself. "You're not a boy anymore." Besides, he'd always been vigorous. Maybe it was just a cold, a virus, the lingering effects of bad weather, some stomach bug. He'd just work his way out of it. He added weight to his pack, took to carrying a loaded magazine in his rifle. He'd gotten lazy, that's all. That was easily remedied. He was nothing if not a determined man. For a month or so it worked. Sure, he was even more tired, but that was to be expected with the extra 5 kilos of weight he carried. He welcomed the additional fatigue as evidence of his warrior's virtue, went back to simpler foods, forced himself to adopt better sleep habits. It helped. The muscle aches were no different from the time he'd entered this demanding life, and he slept the dreamless sleep of the just. What had been tough became tougher still as his focused mind gave its orders to a recalcitrant body. Could he not defeat some invisible microbe? Had he not bested far larger and more formidable organisms? The thought was less a challenge than a petty amusement. As with most determined men, his competition was entirely within himself, the body resisting what the mind commanded. But it never quite went away. Though his body became leaner and harder, the aches and the nausea persisted. He became annoyed with it, and the annoyance first surfaced in jokes. When his senior colleagues took note of his discomfort, he called it morning sickness, evoking gales of rough laughter. He bore the discomfort for another month, then found that it was necessary to lighten his load to maintain his place in front with the leaders. For the first time in his life, faint doubts appeared like wispy clouds in the clear sky of his determined self-image. It was no longer an amusement. He stuck with it for still another month, never slacking in his routine except for the additional hour of sleep that he imposed on his otherwise tireless regimen. Despite this, his condition worsened. Well, not exactly worsened, but did not improve a bit. Maybe it was merely the increasing years, he finally admitted to himself. He was, after all, only a man, however hard he worked to perfect his form. There was no disgrace in that, determined though he might have been to prevent it. Finally, he started grumbling about it. His comrades were understanding. All of them were younger than he, many having served their leader for 5 years or more. They revered him for his toughness, and if the toughness showed a few hairline cracks, what did it mean except that he was human after all, and all the more admirable because of it?
One or two suggested home remedies, but finally a close friend and comrade told him that he was foolish indeed not to see one of the local doctors. His sister's husband was a good one, a graduate of British medical schools. Determined as he was to avoid this abnegation of his person, it was time to take what he knew to be good advice. The doctor was as good as advertised. Sitting behind his desk in a laboratory coat the color of starched white, he took a complete medical history, then performed a preliminary examination. There was nothing overtly wrong. He talked about stress, something his patient needed no lectures about, and pointed out that over the years stress claimed an increasing heavy forfeit on those who bore it. He talked about good eating habits, how exercise could be overdone, how rest was important. He decided that the problem was a combination of various small things, including what was probably a small but annoying intestinal disorder, and prescribed a drug to ameliorate it. The doctor concluded his lecture with a soliloquy about patients who were too proud to do what was good for them, and how foolish they were. The patient nodded approvingly, according the physician deserved respect. He'd given not dissimilar lectures to his own subordinates, and was as determined as always to do things in exactly the right way. The medication worked for a week or so. His stomach almost returned to normal. Certainly it improved, but he noted with annoyance that it wasn't quite the same as before. Or was it? It was, he admitted to himself, hard to remember such trivial things as how one felt on awakening. The mind, after all, concerned itself with the great ideas, like mission and purpose, and left the body to attend its own needs and leave the mind alone. The mind wasn't supposed to be bothered. The mind gave orders and expected them to be followed. It didn't need distractions like this. How could purpose exist with distractions? He'd determined his life's purpose long years before. But it simply would not go away. And finally, he had to return to the physician. A more careful examination was undertaken. He allowed his body to be poked and prodded, to have his blood drawn by a needle instead of the more violent instruments for which he had prepared himself. Maybe it was something almost serious, the physician told him, a low-order systemic infection, for example. There were drugs to treat that. Malaria, once pandemic to the region, for example, had similar but more serious debilitating effects, as did any number of maladies which had once been serious but were now easily defeated by the forces available to modern medicine. The tests would show what was wrong, and the doctor was determined to fix it. He knew of his patient's purpose in life, and shared it from a safer and more distant perspective. He returned to the doctor's office 2 days later. Immediately he knew that something was wrong. He'd seen the same look often enough on the face of his intelligence officer. Something unexpected. Something to interfere with plans. The doctor began speaking slowly, searching for words, trying to find a way to make the message easier. But the patient would have none of that. He had chosen to live a dangerous life and demanded the information as directly as he would have given it. The physician nodded respectfully and replied in kind. The man took the news dispassionately. He was accustomed to disappointments of many kinds. He knew what lay at the end of every life and had many times helped to deliver it to others. So, now it lay in his path also, to be avoided if possible, but there nonetheless, perhaps near, perhaps not. He asked what could be done, and the news was less bad than he had expected. The doctor did not insult him with words of comfort, but read his patient's mind and explained the facts of the matter. There were things to be done. They might succeed. They might not. Time would tell. His physical strength would help a great deal, as would his iron determination. A proper state of mind, the physician told him, was highly important. The patient almost smiled at that, but stopped himself. Better to show the courage of a stoic man than the hope of a fool. And what was death, after all? Had he not lived a life dedicated to justice, to the will of God?
Had he not sacrificed his life to a great and worthy purpose? But that was the rub. He was not a man who planned on failure. He had selected a goal for his life, and years before determined to reach it regardless of cost to himself or others. On that altar he had sacrificed everything he might have been, the dreams of his dead parents, the education which they had hoped he would use for the betterment of himself and others, a normal, comfortable life with a woman who might bear him sons. All of that he had rejected in favor of a path of toil, danger, and utter determination to reach that single shining goal. And now? Was it all for nothing? Was his life to end without meaning? Would he never see the day for which he had lived? Was God that cruel? All these thoughts paraded through his consciousness while his face remained neutral, his eyes guarded as always. No. He would not let that be. God could not have deserted him. He would see the day, or at least see it grow closer. His life would have meaning after all. It had not been all for nothing, nor would what future he might yet have be for nothing. On that, too, he was determined. Ismail Kati would follow his doctor's orders, do what must be done to extend his time, and perhaps defeat this internal enemy, as insidious and contemptible as those outside. In the meantime, he would redouble his efforts, push himself to the limits of physical endurance, ask his God for guidance, look for a sign of his will. As he had fought his other enemies, so would he fight this one, with courage and total dedication. He'd never known mercy in his life, after all, and he would not start showing it now. If he had to face death, the deaths of others paled even further than usual. But he would not lash out blindly. He would do what he had to do. He would carry on as before, waiting for the chance that his faith told him must lie somewhere beyond his sight, between himself and the end of his path. His determination had always been directed by intelligence. It was that which explained his effectiveness. Chapter 2. Labyrinths. The letter from Georgetown arrived in a Roman office, scarce minutes after transmission, where, as with any bureaucracy, the night clerk, what intelligence agencies call a watch officer, simply dropped it on the proper desk and went back to his studies for an exam on the metaphysical discourses of Aquinas. A young Jesuit priest named Hermann Schoner, private secretary to Francisco Alcalde, Father General of the Society of Jesus, arrived the next morning promptly at 7 and began sorting the overnight mail. The fax from America was third from the top and stopped the young cleric in his tracks. Cipher traffic was a routine part of his job, but was not all that common. The code prefix at the top of the communication indicated the originator and the priority. Father Schoner hurried through the rest of the mail and went immediately to work. The procedure was an exact inversion of what Father Riley had done, except that Schoner's typing skills were excellent. He used an optical scanner to transcribe the text into a personal computer and punched up the decryption program. Irregularities on the facsimile copy caused some garbles, but that was easily fixed, and clear text copy, still in Attic Greek, of course, slid out of the inkjet printer. It had required merely 20 minutes, as opposed to Riley's 3 laborious hours. The young priest prepared morning coffee for himself and his boss, then read the letter with his second cup of the day. How extraordinary, Schoner reflected. Reverend Francisco Alcalde was an elderly but uncommonly vigorous man. At 66 he still played a fair game of tennis, and was known to ski with the Holy Father. A gaunt, wiry 6'4", his thick mane of gray hair was brush-cut over deep-set owlish eyes. Alcalde was a man with solid intellectual credentials. The master of 11 languages, had he not been a priest, he might have become the foremost medieval historian in Europe. But he was, before all things, a priest whose administrative duties chafed against his desire for both teaching and pastoral ministry. In a few years he would leave his post as Father General of Roman Catholicism's largest and most powerful order, and find himself again as a university instructor, illuminating young minds and leaving campus to celebrate Mass in a small working-class parish where he could concern himself with ordinary human needs. That, he thought, would be the final blessing of a life cluttered with so many of them. Not a perfect man, he frequently wrestled with the pride that attended his intellect, trying and not always succeeding to cultivate the humility necessary to his vocation. Well, he sighed, perfection was a goal never to be reached, and he smiled at the humor of it. "Guten Morgen, Hermann," he said, sweeping through the door. "Buongiorno," the German priest replied, then lapsed into Greek. "Something interesting this morning?" The bushy eyebrows twitched at the message, and he jerked his head toward the inner office. Schoener followed with the coffee. "The tennis court is reserved for 4 o'clock," Schoener said as he poured his boss's cup. "So you can humiliate me yet again?" It was occasionally joked that Schoener could turn professional, contributing his winnings to the society, whose members were required to take a vow of poverty. "So, what is the message?" "From Timothy Riley in Washington." Schoener handed it over. Alcalde donned his reading glasses and read slowly. He left his coffee untouched and, on finishing the message, read through it again. Scholarship was his life, and Alcalde rarely spoke about something without reflection.
"Remarkable. I've heard of this Ryan fellow before. Isn't he in intelligence?"
"Deputy director of the American CIA. We educated him. Boston College and Georgetown. He's principally a bureaucrat, but he's been involved in several operations in the field. We don't know all of the details, but it would appear that none were improper. We have a small dossier on him. Father Riley speaks very highly of Dr. Ryan."
"So I see."
Alcalde pondered that for a moment. He and Riley had been friends for 30 years.
"He thinks this proposal may be genuine. And you, Hermann?"
"Potentially, it is a gift from God."
The comment was delivered without irony.
"Indeed, but an urgent one. What of the American president?"
"I would guess that he has not yet been briefed, but soon will be."
"As to his character?"
Schoener shrugged.
"He could be a better man."
"Who of us could not?" Alcalde said, staring at the wall.
"Yes, Father."
"How is my calendar for today?"
Schoener ran over the list from memory.
"Very well. Call Cardinal D'Antonio and tell him that I have something of importance. Fiddle the schedule as best you can. This is something that calls for immediate attention. Call Timothy, thank him for his message, and tell him that I am working on it."
Ryan awoke reluctantly at 5:30. The sun was an orange-pink glow that backlit the trees, 10 miles away on Maryland's eastern shore. His first considered course of action was to draw the shades. Kathy didn't have to go into Hopkins today, though it took him half the walk to the bathroom to remember why. His next action was to take 2 extra-strength Tylenol. He'd had too much to drink the previous night, and that, he reminded himself, was 3 days in a row. But what was the alternative? Sleep came increasingly hard to him, despite work hours that grew longer and fatigue that... "Damn," he said, squinting at himself in the mirror. He looked terrible. He padded his way into the kitchen for coffee. Everything was better after coffee. His stomach contracted itself into a tight, resentful ball on seeing the wine bottle still sitting on the countertop. A bottle and a half, he reminded himself. Not 2. He hadn't drunk 2 full bottles. 1 had already been opened. It wasn't that bad. Ryan flipped the switch for the coffee machine and headed for the garage.
There he climbed into the station wagon and drove to the gate to get his paper. Not all that long ago he'd walked out to get it, but hell, he told himself, he wasn't dressed. That was the reason. The car radio was set to an all-news station, and he got his first exposure to what the world was doing. The ball scores. The Orioles had lost again. Damn. And he was supposed to take Little Jack to a game. He'd promised after the last Little League game he'd missed. And when, he asked himself, are you going to do that? Next April? Damn. Well, the whole season, practically, was ahead. School wasn't even out yet. He'd get to it. Sure. Ryan tossed the Morning Post on the car seat and drove back to the house. The coffee was ready. First good news of the day. Ryan poured himself a mug and decided against breakfast. Again. That was bad, a part of his mind warned him. His stomach was in bad enough shape already, and two mugs of straight-dripped coffee would not help. He forced his mind into the paper to stifle that voice. It is not often appreciated how much intelligence services depend on the news media for their information. Part of it was functional. They were in much the same business, and the intelligence services didn't have the brain market cornered. More to the point, Ryan reflected, the newsies didn't pay people for information. Their confidential sources were driven either by conscience or anger to leak whatever information they let out, and that made for the best sort of information. Any intelligence officer could tell you that. Nothing like anger or principle to get a person to leak all sorts of juicy stuff. Finally, though the media was replete with lazy people, quite a few smart ones were drawn by the better money that went with news gathering. Ryan had learned which bylines to read slowly and carefully, and he noted the datelines as well. As deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency, he knew which department heads were strong and which were weak. The Post gave him better information, for example, than the German desk. The Middle East was still quiet. The Iraq business was finally settling out. The new arrangement over there was taking shape at long last. Now if we could just do something about the Israeli side. It would be nice, he thought, to set that whole area to rest. And Ryan believed it possible. The East-West confrontation which had predated his birth was now a thing of history. And who would have believed that? Ryan refilled his mug without looking. Something that even a hangover allowed him to do. And all in just a brief span of years. Less time, in fact, than he had spent in the agency. Damn. Who would have believed it? Now that was so amazing that Ryan wondered how long people would be writing books about it. Generations, at least. The next week a KGB representative was coming into Langley to seek advice on parliamentary oversight. Ryan had counseled against letting him in, and the trip was being handled with the utmost secrecy because the agency still had Russians working for it, and the knowledge that KGB and CIA had instituted official contacts on anything would terrify them. Equally true, Ryan admitted to himself, of Americans still in the employ of KGB. Probably. It was an old friend coming over, Sergei Golovko. Friend, Ryan snorted, turning to the sports page. The problem with the morning paper was that it never had the results of last night's game. Jack's return to the bathroom was more civilized. He was awake now, though his stomach was even less happy with the world. Two antacid tablets helped that, and the Tylenol were working. He'd reinforced that with two more at work. By 6:15, he was washed, shaved, and dressed. He kissed his still-sleeping wife on the way out, was rewarded by a vague, and opened the front door in time to see the car pulling up the driveway. It troubled Ryan vaguely that his driver had to awaken far earlier than he to get here on time. It bothered him a little more who his driver was. "Morning, Doc," John Clark said with a gruff smile. Ryan slid into the front seat. There was more leg room, and he thought it would insult the man to sit in back. "Hi, John," Jack replied. "Tied it on again last night, eh, Doc?" Clark thought. "Damn fool. For someone as smart as you are, how can you be so dumb? Not getting the jogging in either, are you?"
he wondered on seeing how tight the DDCI's belt looked. Well, he'd just have to learn, as Clark had learned, that late nights and too much booze were for dumb kids. John Clark had turned into a paragon of healthy virtue before reaching Ryan's age. He figured that it had saved his life at least once.
"Quiet night," Clark said next, heading out the driveway.
"That's nice." Ryan picked up the dispatch box and dialed in the code. He waited until the light flashed green before opening it. Clark was right. There wasn't much to be looked at.
By the time they were halfway to Washington, he'd read everything and made a few notes. "Going to see Carol and the kids tonight?" Clark asked as they passed over Maryland Route 3.
"Yeah, it is tonight, isn't it?"
"Yep." It was a regular once-a-week routine. Carol Zimmer was the Laotian widow of Air Force Sergeant Buck Zimmer, and Ryan had promised to take care of the family after Buck's death. Few people knew of it. Fewer people knew of the mission on which Buck had died, but it gave Ryan great satisfaction. Carol now owned a 7-Eleven between Washington and Annapolis. It gave her family a steady and respectable income when added to her husband's pension, and with the educational trust fund that Ryan had established, guaranteed that each of the eight would have a college degree when the time came, as it had already come for the eldest son. It would be a long haul to finish that up. The youngest was still in diapers. "Those punks ever come back?" Jack asked. Clark just turned and grinned. For several months after Carol had taken over the business, some local toughs had been hanging out at the store. They had objected to a Laotian woman and her mixed-race kids owning a business in the semi-rural area. Finally, she had mentioned it to Clark. John had given them one warning, which they had been too dense to heed. Perhaps they'd mistaken him for an off-duty police officer, someone not to be taken too seriously. John and his Spanish-speaking friend had set things right, and after the gang leader had gotten out of the hospital, the punks had never come near the place. The local cops had been very understanding, and business had shown an immediate 20% increase. "I wonder if that guy's knee ever came all the way back," Clark wondered with a wistful smile. "Maybe now he'll take up an honest trade."
"How are the kids doing?"
"You know, it's kind of hard to get used to the idea of having one in college, Doc. A little tough on Sandy, too."
"Doc."
"Yeah, John?"
"Pardon my saying so, but you look a little rocky. You want to back it off a little."
"That's what Kathy says." It occurred to Jack to tell Clark to mind his own business, but you didn't say that sort of thing to a man like Clark. And besides, he was a friend. And besides that, he was correct.
"Docs are usually right," John pointed out.
"I know. It's just a little stressful at the office. Got some stuff happening, and
exercise beats the hell out of booze, man. You're one of the smartest guys I know. Act smart."
End of advice. Clark shrugged and returned his attention to the morning traffic.
"You know, John, if you had decided to become a doc, you would have been very effective," Jack replied with a chuckle.
"How so?"
"With a bedside manner like yours, people would be afraid not to do what you said."
"I am the most even-tempered man I know," Clark protested.
"Right. No one's ever lived long enough for you to get really mad. They're dead by the time you're mildly annoyed."
And that was why Clark was Ryan's driver. Jack had engineered his transfer out of the Directorate of Operations to become a security and protective officer. DCI Cabot had eliminated fully 20% of the field force, and people with paramilitary experience had been first on the block. Clark's expertise was too valuable to lose, and Ryan had bent two rules and outright evaded a third to accomplish this much, aided and abetted by Nancy Cummings and a friend in the admin directorate. Besides, Jack felt very safe around this man, and he was able to train the new kids in the SPO unit. He was even a superb driver, and as usual, he got Ryan into the basement garage right on time. The agency Buick slid into its spot, and Ryan got out, fiddling with his keys.
The one for the executive elevator was on the end, and 2 minutes later he arrived at the 7th floor, walking from the corridor to his office. The DDCI's office adjoins the long, narrow suite accorded the DCI, who was not at work yet. A small, surprisingly modest place for the number 2 man in the country's premier intelligence service, it overlooked the visitor parking lot, beyond which was the thick stand of pines that separated the agency compound from the George Washington Parkway and the Potomac River Valley beyond. Ryan had kept Nancy Cummings from his previous and brief stint as Deputy Director Intelligence. Clark took his seat in that office, going over dispatches that pertained to his duties in preparation for the morning SPO conference. They concerned themselves with which terrorist group was making noise at the moment. No serious attempt had ever been made on a senior agency executive, but history was not their institutional concern. The future was, and even CIA didn't have a particularly bright record for predicting that. Ryan found his desk neatly piled with material too sensitive for the car's dispatch case, and prepped himself for the morning department head meeting, which he co-chaired with the DCI. There was a drip coffee machine in his office. Next to it was a clean but never used mug that had once belonged to the man who'd brought him into the agency, Vice Admiral James Greer. Nancy took care of that, and Ryan never began a day at Langley without thinking of his dead boss. So, he rubbed his hands across his face and eyes and went to work. What new and interesting things did the world hold in store this day? The logger, like most of his trade, was a big, powerful man. 6'4" and 220 pounds of former All-State defensive end, he'd joined the Marines instead of going to college. Could have, he thought, could have taken the scholarship to Oklahoma or Pitt, but he'd decided against it. And he knew that he would never have wanted to leave Oregon for good. A college degree would have meant that. Maybe play pro ball and then turn into a suit? No. Since childhood, he'd loved the outdoor life. He made a good living, raised his family in a friendly small town, lived a rough, healthy life, and was the best damn man in the company for dropping a tree straight and soft. He drew the special ones. He yanked the string on the big two-man chainsaw. On a silent command, his helper took his end off the ground as the logger did the same. The tree had already been notched with a double-headed axe. They worked the saw in slowly and carefully. The logger kept one eye on the chainsaw while the other watched the tree. There was an art to doing this just right. It was a point of honor with him that he didn't waste an inch of wood he didn't have to. Not like the guys down at the mill, though they'd told him that the mill wouldn't touch this baby. They pulled the saw after completing the first cut and started the second without pausing for breath. This time it took 4 minutes. The logger was tensely alert now. He felt the puff of wind on his face and paused to make sure it was blowing the way he wanted. A tree, no matter how large, was a plaything for a stiff wind, especially when nearly cut in half. It was swaying at the top now. Almost time. He backed the saw off and waved to his helper. "Watch my eyes. Watch my hands." The kid nodded seriously. About another foot would do it, the logger knew. They completed it very slowly. It abused the chain, but this was the dangerous part. Safety guys were monitoring the wind and... Now! The logger brought the saw out and dropped it. The helper took the cue and backed off 10 yards as his boss did the same. Both watched the base of the tree. If it kicked, that would tell them of the danger. But it didn't. As always, it seemed so agonizingly slow. This was the part the Sierra Club liked to film, and the logger understood why. So slow, so agonizing, like the tree knew it was dying, and was trying not to, and losing, and the groan of the wood was a moan of despair. Well, yes, he thought. It did seem like that, but it was only a goddamn tree. The cut widened as he watched, and the tree fell. The top was moving very fast now, but the danger was at the bottom, and that's what he continued to watch. As the trunk passed through the 45-degree mark, the wood parted completely.
The body of the tree kicked then, moving over the stump about 4 feet, like the death rattle of a man. Then, the noise. The immense swish of the top branches ripping through the air. He wondered quickly how fast the top was moving. Speed of sound, maybe? No, not that fast. And then, whoomp! The tree actually bounced, but softly, when it hit the wet ground. Then it lay still. It was lumber now. I was always a little sad. It had been a pretty tree. The Japanese official came over next, the logger was surprised to see. He touched the tree and murmured something that must have been a prayer. That amazed him. It seemed like something an Indian would do. Interesting, the logger thought. He didn't know that Shinto was an animistic religion with many similarities to those of Native Americans. Talking to the spirit of the tree? Next, he came to the logger.
You have great skill, the little Japanese said with an exquisitely polite bow.
Thank you, sir. The logger nodded his head. It was the first Japanese he'd ever met. Seemed like a nice enough guy.
And saying a prayer to the tree. That add class, the logger thought on reflection.
A great pity to kill something so magnificent.
Yeah, I guess it is. Is it true that you will put this in a church, like?
Oh, yes. We no longer have trees like this, and we need 4 huge beams, 20 meters each. This one tree will do all of them, I hope, the man said, looking back at the fallen giant. They must all come from a single tree. It is the tradition of the temple, you see.
Ought to, the logger judged. How old's the temple?
1,200 years. The old beams. They were damaged in the earthquake 2 years ago and must be replaced very soon. With luck, these should last as long. I hope they will. It is a fine tree.
Under the supervision of the Japanese official, the fallen tree was cut into manageable segments. They weren't all that manageable. Quite a bit of special equipment had to be assembled to get this monster out, and Georgia Pacific was charging a huge amount of money for the job. But that was not a problem. The Japanese, having selected the tree, paid without blinking. The representative even apologized for the fact that he didn't want the GP mill to work the tree. It was a religious thing, he explained slowly and clearly, and no insult to the American workers was intended. The senior GP executive nodded. That was okay with him. It was their tree now. They'd let it season for a little while before loading it on an American flag timber carrier for the trip across the Pacific, where the log would be worked with skill and due religious ceremony. By hand, the GP man was amazed to hear, for its new and special purpose, that it would never reach Japan, was something that none of them knew.
The term troubleshooter was particularly awkward for a law enforcement official, Murray thought. Of course, as he leaned back in the leather chair, he could feel the 10mm Smith & Wesson automatic clipped to his waistband. He ought to have left it in his desk drawer, but he liked the feel of the beast. A revolver man for most of his career, he'd quickly come to love the compact power of the Smith. And Bill understood. For the first time in recent memory, the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation was a career cop who'd started his career on the street, busting bad guys. In fact, Murray and Shaw had started off in the same field division. Bill was slightly more skilled at the administrative side, but no one mistook him for a headquarters weenie. Shaw had first gotten high-level attention by staring down 2 armed bank robbers before the cavalry'd had time to arrive. He'd never fired his weapon in anger, of course. Only a tiny percentage of FBI agents ever did, but he'd convinced those 2 hoods that he could drop both of them. There was steel under the gentlemanly velvet and 1 hell of a brain. Which was why Dan Murray, a deputy assistant director, didn't mind working as Shaw's personal problem solver.
What the hell do we do with this guy? Shaw asked with quiet disgust.
Murray had just finished his report on the Warrior case. Dan sipped at his coffee and shrugged.
Bill, the man is a genius with corruption cases. Best we've ever had. He just doesn't know dick about the muscle end of the business. He got out of his depth with this one. Luckily enough, no permanent damage was done. And Murray was right. The newsies had treated the Bureau surprisingly well for saving the life of their reporter. What was truly amazing was the fact that the newsies had never quite understood that the reporter had had no place in that particular arena. As a result, they were grateful to the local SAC for letting the news team on the scene, and grateful to the hostage rescue team for saving both of them when things had taken a dangerous turn. It wasn't the first time the Bureau had reaped a PR bonanza from a near catastrophe. The FBI was more jealous of its public relations than any government agency, and Shaw's problem was simply that to fire SAC Walt Huskins would look bad. Murray pressed on. He's learned his lesson. Walt isn't stupid, Bill. And bagging the governor last year was some coup, wasn't it? Shaw grimaced. Huskins was a genius at political corruption cases. A state governor was now contemplating life in a federal prison because of him. That was how Huskins had become a special agent in charge in the first place. You have something in mind, Dan? ASAC Denver, Murray replied with a mischievous twinkle. It's elegant. He goes from a little field office to head of corruption cases in a major field division. It's a promotion that takes him out of command and puts him back in what he's best at. And if the rumbles we're getting out of Denver are right, he'll have lots of work to do. Like maybe a senator and a congressman. Maybe more. The preliminary indications on the water project look big. I mean real big, Bill. Like $20 million changing hands. Shaw whistled respectfully at that. All that for one senator and one Congress critter? Like I said, maybe more. The latest thing is some environmental types being paid off, in government and out. Who do we have better at unraveling a ball of yarn that big? Walt's got a nose for this sort of thing. The man can't draw his gun without losing a few toes, but he's one hell of a bird dog. Murray closed the folder in his hands. Anyway, he wanted me to look around and make a recommendation. Send him to Denver or retire him. Mike Delaney is willing to rotate back this way. His kid's gonna start at GW this fall, and Mike wants to teach down at the academy. That gives you the opening. It's all very neat and tidy, but it's your call, Director. Thank you, Mr. Murray, Director Shaw said gravely. Then his face broke into a grin. Remember when all we had to worry about was chasing bank bandits? I hate this admin crap. Maybe we shouldn't have caught so many, Dan agreed. We'd still be working Riverside Philly and having a beer with the troops at night. Why do people toast success? It just screws up your life. We're both talking like old farts. We both are old farts, Bill, Murray pointed out. But at least I don't travel around with a protective detail. You son of a bitch. Shaw gagged and dribbled coffee down his necktie. Oh, Christ, Dan, he gasped, laughing. Look what you made me do. Bad sign when a guy can't hold his coffee, Director. Out. Get the orders cut before I bust you back to the street. Oh, no, please, not that. Anything but that. Murray stopped laughing and turned semi-serious for a moment. What's Kenny doing now? Just got his assignment to his submarine, USS Maine. Bonnie's doing fine with the baby, due in December. Dan?
Yeah, Bill?
Nice call on Huskins. I needed an easy out on that. Thanks.
No problem, Bill. Walt will jump at it. I wish they were all this easy.
You following up on the Warrior Society? Freddie Warder's working on it. We just might roll those bastards up in a few months. And both knew that would be nice. There were not many domestic terrorist groups left. Reducing their number by one more by the end of the year would be another major coup. It was dawn in the Dakota Badlands. Marvin Russell knelt on the hide of a bison, facing the sunrise. He wore jeans, but was bare-chested and barefoot. He was not a tall man, but there was no mistaking the power in him.
During his first and only stint in prison, for burglary, he'd learned about pumping iron. It had begun merely as a hobby to work off surplus energy, had grown with the understanding that physical strength was the only form of self-defense that a man in the penitentiary could depend upon.